Hi, everyone. Lee Arnold here with you for another podcast, this week featuring the high priest of country music, Conway Twitty. But before we start this conversation, here are a few words from our sponsor. Country Music Conversations with Lee Arnold's podcast is made possible by our sponsor, MarketSmith, Inc., the digital media agency that's been growing brands like Tumi, SharkNinja, New Jersey Lottery, PSE&G, Blue Mercury Cosmetics, and Dick's Sporting Goods. You know what makes this agency so good at what they do? Because simply being a marketing agency is no longer enough. Solution-based, problem-solving, and ever-evolving, they create enduring value for DTC and B2B brands by opening up and growing marketing channels. Their patented AI offerings, informed by human intelligence, allow them to act with agility and intellect. I was speaking with the CEO not too long ago, and she was saying they take on clients who know who they are, who want to grow, and clients that know what they want. These big brands choose MarketSmith because they want to merge with a partner who'll make them exceptional and an agency that will grow their revenue. Digital marketing is not easy, but MarketSmith, Inc. knows when to make the media dollars work hard for their clients. You have a brand you want to grow? Well, contact MarketSmith.com and tell them Lee Arnold sent you. Conway, in every sense of the word, was a superstar. He could sing ballads and up-tempo material with the same ease, utilizing his famous growl. The minute he hit the stage, he had the audience in the palm of his hands. In his early career, he was a rockabilly star who sounded a lot like Elvis. His first signature song, It's Only Make Believe, he wrote with his drummer Jack Nance while appearing at the Flamingo Lounge in Toronto. He made the decision to change to country music in 1965, and he never looked back. From 1971 to 1976, the CMA awarded him for his duets with Loretta Lynn, and he was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame and also the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. Conway had an uncanny talent for listening to a song and knowing whether it was a hit or not. When it was time to record an album, he would sit for hours listening to hundreds of songs before deciding which ones had the potential of becoming a success before going into the studio. He was so versatile and successful in not only recording traditional country music, like his other career song, Hello Darlin', but scored with remakes of pop hits like The Rose, Slow Hand, or Tight Fittin' Jeans. In his career, he had 55 number one hits, which at the time was a record, until George Strait came along with a song called Wrapped for his 56th number one hit, which broke Conway's record. Conway was an astute businessman as well. He built a country music entertainment complex in Hendersonville, Tennessee, called Twitty City, and it cost $3.5 million. And he also lived there. Conway's other passion was baseball. He even was drafted for the Philadelphia Phillies until Uncle Sam came along, so he had to serve his country. Unfortunately, Conway passed away following surgery for an abdominal aortic aneurysm, and he was only 59 years old at the time. Conway Twitty was quite intelligent and had a calm demeanor. Our conversation took place at Twitty City during Fanfare in 1989. We talked about his secret for success, songwriting career, his duets with Loretta, and a whole lot more. Now, our conversation with Conway Twitty. Lee Arnold at the famous Twitty City. There's only one in the world, and the man who created it all, I'm sitting right next to now, the one and only Conway Twitty. It's nice to be here, especially during Fanfare Week, Conway.
Yeah, thank you, Lee. Yeah, this is a super week for us here.
Yeah, I guess every week is super, but Fanfare is kind of special because it's the week that the business is all about.
That's right. It's the one time during the year that the music business and all the people in it salute the country music fan, and it took it a long time to happen, the fanfare, I mean, and then but boy, since it started, it's been growing every year, getting better and better.
You've set all kinds of records throughout the years in many, many ways, and right now I think you're approaching another milestone in your career, a silver anniversary of recording 25 years.
Well, that's in country music.
In country music, but back beyond that, back to 1958 in the rockabilly field.
That's right. That's another 10 years I actually got into the rock thing in 1956. Mm-hmm. So I was in that for 10 years before I finally switched to country music in 1965.
Mm-hmm. Some careers with country music artists just kind of reach a peak and then just level off. Yours has been a steady growth ever since you started. What's the secret?
Well, I always looked at my career like a love affair,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's something that started slow, and I never hired the publicity firms or the people that you hire to blow up a career like mine, blow it up into something bigger than it really is. Once you get it blown up, it's only got one way to go. So I have done mine strictly with music down through the years. None of the hype, I've never been mixed up in politics and the music business. I've always done it with one song right after another. And with 53 number one records and I don't know, another 10 or 15 number twos and threes and fours and things like that. So I've just done mine with music, and that's why it's taken so long, just little by little by little. And every year it gets a little bit bigger and a little bit better but it's not by accident that it's that way. We planned it that way.
I'm just thinking about the current talent out there, and I know you, as an entertainer and performer, are very aware of the competitive factor in country music, just like athletes are, whether you're a tennis player or a golfer. You're always looking behind you. Who's going to creep up on you or maybe even catch up or even take over? Who are some of the names and faces that you're kind of impressed with today?
Oh, of course, I like Randy Travis. He's a nice person and a friend of mine, and he's really the first one that comes to mind.
I know you like Skip Ewing too.
Oh yeah, I forgot about Skip. There's a bunch I'm going to forget about right here.
That's okay.
And the guy that wears the funny cowboy hat that won all the awards, you know.
Oh, Ricky Van Shelton.
Ricky Van Shelton, yeah, is a nice young man and does a good job. But I don't look at these people as competition. I think you are your own competition in this business. Mm-hmm. There's room for everybody. And you make it on your own merits and on your own talent, mm-hmm. and you go out of this business because you lose it somewhere, not because Ricky Van Shelton comes along or somebody else. You make mistakes, and I realized that years ago and vowed that I would never make those mistakes. If you know what they are, mm-hmm. if you know there's a snake in the grass, you don't have to get bit, right? And so you learn your trade, and you found out why some of your friends are laying along the side of the road back down through the years, and people who still just as talented today are singing just as good as they ever did, but they've made some mistakes somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I've tried my best not to make those mistakes, and consequently am still here. And no, I consider my own self my own competition.
That's great. That's a wonderful thing to consider yourself your own competition. You're always striving for something better.
Right. That's exactly right.
You, of all things, Conway, I think more than any other artist, have that secret, certain mystique about you to have the knack of hearing and knowing a good song. You have an ear for material that never misses, consistently, year in, year out. And I know you go through an awful lot because you're a good listener when it comes to music.
If there's any so-called secret to my, or one key thing to my longevity in this business, it is the fact that I do have a really good ear for a song. And I've always known that it's a song, not so much the singer. It's about 99% song and 1% everything else. Mm-hmm. And because I know that, I go through about 2,500 to 3,000 songs every time I get ready to record to do an album. And that's just 10 songs. And I agonize over these things for 3 or 4 months before I actually do the album. And I might get the songs down to 200, and then it's really hard to get them down to 100. And then it's hard to get them down to 50, and I usually wind up keeping 75 or 80 that I really really like, and I can't get to. And when I get ready to do my next album next year, mm-hmm. I put those same songs back into the pot again.
You've also had the luxury of not having to rely, in part, on a lot of other writers because you yourself have written some pretty heavyweight songs that have turned out to be enormous classics.
Well, that's a gigantic plus for any artist. If you know, finding good material is the key thing. Mm-hmm. And if you can write them, then you certainly have the first shot at them. And I have. I've written something like around 19 or 20 of the number one records I've had, mm-hmm. plus hundreds of album things I've done through the years.
You, in recent years, a few years ago, shied away from TV and exposure on TV. And now you're back very visible, not only on TNN, but on the network. You recently did David Letterman. You'll be doing Pat Sajak this summer and also The Tonight Show. How so?
Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier that I had never hired the publicity firms and to blow up your career. But I've been here 33 years now, right? And I think it's time to do something like that. I can go on and take my career up to that one final level, I think. And I'm not going to get overexposed at this point in my career. And so I have hired that company, and they're getting me the Tonight Show and the different things. I'm still, you know, after 33 years, I'm still a fresh face for television. Mm-hmm. And I can sit and do an interview with Lee Arnold. And it's something, I mean, it's not old hat to you. Mm-hmm. Although you and I have known each other for years, down through the years, we've done a few interviews, you and I.
True. I'm thinking about special people in your life, and probably the most special person is Dee Henry, your wife, who's not only your wife, but wears many, many hats mm-hmm. in Conway Twitty's life. Your co-producer, your advisor, your business partner. And Dee brings something very, very special to your life. I guess there's got to be chemistry between two people, and that's the kind of thing, like a flower, it just grows and you intertwine.
It's, if you go through this life, and you manage to meet up with one person like that, whether they're your wife or it's another guy and he's your friend, mm-hmm. a friend for life like that, someone that you're that close to and that you can communicate that well with, you're a very fortunate person. And the fact that she happens to be my wife just makes it even better. And we are very, very good friends and I think soulmates for a long, long time.
That's great. That's wonderful to hear. You're in a big health regimen these days. Really was a change in lifestyle. You gave up smoking, I understand, 3.5 years ago. That changed almost 4, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 4 years ago. I caught myself getting, it's one of those things that I already knew about. Mm-hmm. And I caught myself getting a little bit lazy as far as my songs were concerned. I'd go in the studio and I didn't record them in as high a key as I used to. And on the stage, I might take a song like It's Only Make-Believe, which I just... this gigantic range to it. And the songs that I sing are really high. I drop them to a lower key or maybe even a lower key. Mm-hmm. And it was easier to sing them that way. Right. But not near as much energy. It doesn't take near as much energy to do them, so they don't come off as well. And I caught myself doing that, and I know I contributed to two things. One was smoking, and my throat was paying the price for it. And the other was not proper exercise, and my lungs weren't expanded like they used to be. And I couldn't hold those notes like I used to, and I made up my mind I wasn't going to let that happen to me at this point in my life. I'm not near about through yet doing what I want to do. And I discussed it with my wife and with Jimmy Bowen and our other producer, and he agreed. He said, "I think you got as many years as you want in this business, Conway, because you've got it between the ears. Mm-hmm. You're not going to lose it. And so take care of that voice and your health, and you'll hang around as long as you want to." So I made up my mind to get myself into a health program and off of those cigarettes, and I did. And in the last 4 years, I've moved all the keys back up in my songs to keys I was doing them in 33 years ago.
Wow. So it's like starting over again.
Yeah, it is. It's like starting over again. Yeah. I can do things vocally that I hadn't been able to do in years, and it's a good feeling.
You know, the word superstar and legend is bandied about so much and loosely, but in your case, there's real serious respect when you say Conway Twitty, superstar, the living legend. And in the eyes of the fans and the public, that's what you are. That's the perception. What do you think of yourself as at this point, Conway, after all these years?
Well, I've always said, and I still believe this with all my heart, what you have done means nothing. What you do, what that next record, that's everything. Everything is keyed on that one record. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to words like superstar and what was the other word, legend, and those kind of things, I like it when they're talking about Johnny Cash or Loretta Lynn and George Jones or Merle Haggard. I like it. To me, they are, and I love them, and I'm big fans. But as far as Conway Twitty is concerned, all the stuff I've done doesn't mean anything. Only what I do next is what counts. And so those words just don't register on me very well.
I think a lesson can be learned with your case from other country music artists who've been in this business and where you have succeeded, many others have failed, for the reason that everybody has a tendency when the money starts coming in and success starts, a little bit of it, the little taste of it, have a tendency to spend more than you're making. You've been very careful. You have a great business acumen. And like some other artists, have made some wise investments. And I guess that's a lesson to be learned, not only in country music, but in any business.
That's the key in any business. Country music is a business like any other business. And if you don't learn that one lesson really quick, you're going to be out of business. Mm-hmm. I've seen it happen to so many people. And it's happened to me a few times. You can't. As far as my music business is concerned, I feel like I know it as well as anybody in this business knows it. Mm-hmm. And I take care of that. I have to hire other people to take care of the other things that I get off into, and business advisors and sometimes you may get the wrong person. Sometimes you make a mistake. Sometimes things don't. But, you know, overall, I guess I've wound up in pretty good shape.
Your children, Michael, Joni, and Kathy, kind of have followed in your footsteps. They have their own little musical act now called the Twitty Committee. Mm. Did you urge them at an early age to follow in your career, encourage them in the music business, or did that something that they wanted themselves?
I never encouraged them to get into the music business. Of course, I never discouraged them either. Mm. I only encouraged them to do whatever it is that they feel like, whatever they feel like they want to be, to really go for it. I mean, you've got to pull all stops and work. I don't know any other way except put your head down and your hand in up and work. Like heck, right? That's the only thing I know. And that's what I advise them to do, and whatever it was they chose to do. Three of them decided to get into the music business, and the other one is a professional golfer.
Yeah, Jimbo.
Yeah, Jimmy. Yeah, he's doing good, too.
That's good. Years ago, you did a movie, I think, and you sang a song called Sex Pot Goes to College. Mm. When was that, early 60s?
Sex Pot Goes to College. That I wrote the title song
for
that.
Did you really?
Yeah. I did three movies. That was one of them, and it was all around 1960 and 1961. That particular movie, I think Mamie Van Doren was in it, and Tuesday Weld was in it, and all the good girls back then that were considered sex pot or sex kittens or whatever it was they called them. Yeah, I wrote the title song for that movie and played a part in it. And I was in a couple of others, one called Platinum High and one called College Confidential.
Uh-huh. Did you enjoy doing movies then?
No, I really didn't, and I'll tell you why. At first, I was excited about it because I'd never been around anything like that, and I got out on the MGM lot, and I'd watch as these people who do these things go out. They'd line up about 200 people and go down through there and say, and they're picking the extras for the movies, mm-hmm. and they go down through there and say, okay, I want you and you and you and you and you and you, and then everybody else go home. And I got to thinking, you know, here I am. These people have worked long and hard at their trade, you know, mm-hmm. learning it. And here I am, a singer, over here into what they're doing and taking up one of their spots, something they've worked long and hard for, and I didn't work at all for. And I didn't like the feel of that, so I got out of it.
You, early on, I guess in the eyes of MGM, they tried to create you as another Elvis Presley in your rock and roll career.
Yeah, well, they tried. I, of course, there was no other Elvis Presley. Nobody. There could never be another Elvis Presley. I sounded a little bit like him, I guess. And we talked a lot alike. I thought if we sounded anywhere like it was the way we talked.
Speaking of him.
Yeah, we were born about 30 miles apart in Mississippi, and I guess it just came natural. But the one thing that separated me from him was that little growl in the voice, you know, mm-hmm. little thing I had. And They could say, well, it sounds like Elvis, but that's Conway because there's a little growl. So that really helped me.
Did you ever work with him, Conway, or know him?
I knew him. I never worked any shows with him. I knew him not well, but I knew him.
I understand you also wrote a couple of songs with Roy Orbison at one time.
Yeah, one song. When I was first getting into the music business back in 1956, the first thing I did was go to Memphis, Tennessee, which was close to where I lived, and get with Sam Phillips at Sun Records. Yeah, you know, I didn't know there was another record label besides Sun. Elvis was on there, and of course, Roy Orbison was on there. Johnny Cash was on there. Charlie Rich was on there. Jerry Lee Lewis was about to be on there. Carl Perkins. And that was it, yeah, as far as I was concerned. So I tried to get on there, too. And I had written a song called Rock House. And I took it to Sun Records, to Sam Phillips, and sang it for him, did a demo, you know. I was doing demos all the time, sessions to see what would come up with something. Right. And the next thing I knew, Roy Orbison had a song out called Rock House. But they put my name on it and his.
One of the most successful collaborations of any two artists in the world has been your collaboration as a duet partner through the years with Loretta Lynn. There seems to be an affinity, a friendship, a kinship, something deeper than even friendship. I mean, you're like, as you are a soulmate to Dee Henry, your wife, the same professionally goes with Loretta, is almost like a sister.
Exactly, exactly. I couldn't have said it any better myself. It's almost like another soulmate, Loretta. From the very first day, we sat and talked, Loretta and I and her husband Mooney. Things just clicked. At that point in time, I'd had a lot of big rock records, but I was just getting into country music. Mm-hmm. And unbeknownst to me, she was she didn't like rock and roll music, but she loved the song "It's Only Make Believe" that I had out. And so she was a big Conway Twitty fan and had a big poster in her home and before she even got into the music business. So we found out all these things, and it just clicked right off of the bat. And we, down through the years, have never had a cross word even, never had one argument. And that was one of the concerns of Owen Bradley and some of the people concerned back then when we decided to do this duet. They had seen other duets go on to become not friends and enemies and bitter toward each other and those kind of things because of professional jealousies and things like that. But we just didn't think that would happen to us, and consequently, it never had.
You've had 53 number one singles, 35 top 10 singles, 9 gold albums, and right now enjoying success with maybe will be the 54th number one hit single. She's got a single thing in mind from your latest album, Lonesome, High and Lonesome. House on Olensome Road. Great song.
Oh, thank you. And it's, you notice that song is really up there when you listen to it.
Yeah.
And it's back in those keys where I used to do them years ago. A lot of energy in this song. And naturally, I think it's a super song. It got picked out of close to 3,000 other songs so it stood on its own through a bunch of songs and hung in there. I think this is one of the better albums I've done. The last three albums, I think, for MCA have been among the best things I've done in my whole career.
You also introduced one of the songs from the album on the Letterman Show, which you did, Play Ruby Play. You always had an affinity for those upbeat boogie, get down, and people love to see Conway do that, whether it's tight-fitting jeans or this one.
It's I've never had many singles that are up-tempo songs, but I've always tried to put some of them in my albums. That song I like a lot, the one I did on the Letterman Show. I really like it.
Another one in there that Lacey J. Dalton wrote with Roger Murray called Too White to Sing the Blues. She didn't cut it. It was thrown out of the session, and got it?
She tried to cut it. Lacey tried to record it and just couldn't. She couldn't get it. She said, I just can't sing this song. Well, when you really jump as a singer, you jump in and try to sing, you'll find out why real quick. Right. It's got such a range to it. It goes from down here to really high. So it's you really got to get after it to sing that song. I love it. You can't be too white to sing the blues. I like it.
You also had one in a recent album. We were talking about successes. The last three you say you're really proud of because you're singing in that higher register now that you couldn't get to before. And Still in Your Dreams was another great successful song.
I wish I was still in your dreams. What a nicer thing. Yeah. Well, what a nice thought. Beautiful. I wish I was better at being alone. I wish I was still in your dreams. My God, what a song. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah. We cannot forget about those beautiful moments. I guess if I had to pick the top five, one of the ranking top five personally for me, was a song that may not be one of your favorites, but to me, it really personified what you were all about as far as a great song, a great arrangement, and a great hook, Desperado Love.
Ah, that's really a unique little song. Again, you have to know how good that song. If I release an up-tempo song as a single, uh-huh, it's really got to be unique and in there. So you know that one was. I really do like that little song, yeah.
That did quite. And, of course, the ones you've written for yourself. Controversy was there was plenty of controversy when you wrote what they now refer to as the Boom Boom song. You've never been this far before, right?
Oh, there was a lot of controversy on that.
A lot of stations didn't play it.
Well, I was living in Oklahoma City at the time, and my telephone rang one morning and said, "Hi, Conway, I'm so-and-so-and-so, a disc jockey friend of mine, you know, at a radio station somewhere." And he said, I said, "How you doing?" He said, "Well, I got a little problem here." And I said, "What?" He said, "I can't play this record." And I said, "You can't?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, that's okay. You've played a lot of other records I've had, and I'll have more records out there. If you can't play it, you can't play it." And I hung the phone up, and a few minutes later, it rang again. And another disc jockey told me the same thing. And these are friends, you know, they've played records for years. So after about the fifth call like that, I said, "Hey, wait a minute, hold it. Why can't you play this record? What do you mean you can't play it? What's wrong?" He said, "It's a dirty song." I said, no, this is not it. He said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "What makes you think it's a dirty song?" So he referred to different lines in the song, and one line in particular about my trembling fingers touch forbidden places. And I said, "Oh, you've got to be kidding." He said, "This song's about a young girl who's never been out with a guy before. Come on, Conway." He said, I said, "Now, wait a minute. Let me explain to you what this song's about." Now, I don't have to explain this to women. They understand. But most disc jockeys are men, you know. And let me tell you what this song means. It's songs about a married woman who has never been outside the boundaries of her marriage before. That's what the line means. You've never been this far before. And in there, it says, "I don't know and I don't care what made you tell him you don't love him anymore. She's not with him anymore for whatever the reason. And for the first time, this is somebody you've admired for years, but she's been off limits. And now, all of a sudden, she's free. And simply holding her hand is a forbidden thing to you, someone who's admired this person for so long." It's really a real, very tender line. Women understand that. It's the men who think it's a dirty song. But women did understand it, thank goodness, and they started bombarding those radio stations and play that record. And, of course, it was one of the biggest records I've ever had.
You also, as an artist, unlike any other artist, have had two career songs, two signature songs. It's Only Make Believe, which I think you've cut, what, five times now?
I don't know. I've recorded a few times down through the years. Ronnie McDowell just had a big record on it, too, and I wrote it, so, you know.
Yeah. You did a duet on it.
Oh, and Loretta and I did as a duet, right? That's true. Yeah. And, of course, the other one's Hello, Darling. You're right.
I was going to mention Hello, Darling.
Yeah, two of them.
It's Only Make Believe. Was that a fast song? Did that come fast to you?
You mean as a writer?
Yeah.
Yeah, it took about 6 or 7 minutes.
Really?
The really good ones really come fast. Yeah. For me.
Like they write themselves.
That's right. Yeah. They come from that thing, just you tap into something right outside your mind, a room full of melodies and words. Once you get tuned into that, right, and if nothing happens to break that concentration and that flow that you got going, they just keep coming. You can write one song right after another. But if a telephone rings or a kid cries or somebody, anything breaks that line of thought, yeah, that thing, sometimes it takes months to get it back.
Where did the inspiration for Hello, Darling come? Did you work on that a while, or was that just another one of those?
That was another one of those that just really came quick. But the only little story I got to go with that song is when I got into country music, I had a shoebox full of songs that I had written, you know, when I was singing rock music.
Yeah.
And every time I'd go in and do a session, I'd pull out some of those songs and look them over and record a few of them. And I got into this one session, and I pulled this little song out and started running it down with the band. And Owen Bradley was sitting in there, and he never did really know what I was going to record until we got to doing it out there. Because he left that up to me, and he knew I knew what I was doing. And he came in there and said, "This is a pretty good little song, Conway." He said, "What's the name of it?" I said, "Well, that's the problem. It doesn't have a name." You know, most songs you write got a title that you use over and over and over, a hook that you use over and over in the song. But this one didn't have that at all. And he said, "Well, what are the first two words?" And I said, "Hello, darling." And he said, "You never say them anymore?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, we got to call it Hello, Darling." And I said, "Fine." And he said, "Let me say one other thing. Instead of singing it, you know, instead of singing, 'Hello, darling, nice to see you,' just say it like you've done on a couple other things. Just say it." I said, "Ah, that's right." He hit it. He nailed it. And that was Owen's idea. And from the time I first spoke those two words into that microphone, it was no longer an album cut. It was going to be a giant single for me.
Owen Bradley was a genius in many respects with artists. I mean, he really knew the potential of things that they couldn't see themselves, like the forest for the trees, of to bring out the great creativity of each one, like yourself and Brenda Lee and Loretta and everybody else.
He sure did. And the thing he was really good at was suppressing maybe what he thought and what he might want to do to this song. And he'd hold back long enough to see what the artist had in mind. And he knew that most of the time, if an artist that's worth his salt, he was going to come up with something. And he allowed you to the freedom, the creative freedom to do that. And he didn't inject himself into it all the time. And therein was Owen's biggest talent, as far as I'm concerned.
Another one of your own number ones, which you created and made a hit, was Linda on My Mind, which is still, I guess, requested in a lot of shows you do.
That was almost another signature record. A song, you know, all the songs I've recorded down through the years, at certain points in time, I took the songs out of the show when people begin not to react to them like they used to. And I got all kinds of new ones anyway, so you're constantly
changing.
Right. But Hello, Darling, naturally, is still in my show. It's on make-believe. I still close my shows with it. Linda on My Mind is still in my show. Can't take it out of there.
Yeah.
You take it out, people scream right quick. What would take? Put that song back in there.
I think you were the first one to really make a hero of one of the struggling songwriter and cut his first song, which turned out to be his first big hit, which turned out to be an enormous Conway 20 number one favorite too, Roger Murray's favorite, called Another Bridge to Burn.
I was hoping you were going to say him. Roger is a super, super person. And I just think the world of my wife and I both think a lot of him. And he's written a lot of good things for me. But, yeah, I was one of the first people in town to record one of his songs. And it was Standing on a Bridge, It Just Won't Burn. And it was a number one record for me. And it helped get Roger kicked off in this town. And I'm proud to have been a part of that, because he certainly is one of the best writers to ever come here.
When I heard the lyric, it was almost listening to something that you might have written lyrically. Roger's writing.
Yeah, his melodies and his words. Yeah. A lot like the things that I write. I guess that's why I was so drawn to him as a writer, and I really like him.
Let's just hit a couple of more, two more songs. Oh, yeah, we got a Conway, you've done a lot of message songs in your career. Recently, a song called That's My Job. And on the new album, you have a song called Child with Child about teenage pregnancy. You do get into social commentary every so often.
You just touched upon something I had forgotten to mention to you. Three albums back, I sat down and when I came back with MCA about 2 years ago, came back and I sat down with Jimmy Bowen, and he said, let me just lay something out to you, Conway. He said, I know when you do an album, you try your best to put 10 singles on that album. And I said, yeah, that's what I've done all my life. You know, I really try my best to put 10 singles on it. He said, okay, I want you to quit doing that. He said, and my ears perked up, you know, and I thought, uh-oh. He said, I want you to do 4 songs that you consider now radio things that radio would play right now and could be singles for you. 4 like that. The other 6, we're going to call them, for lack of a better thing, we're going to call them piece of business songs. I want you to record things that you would say, boy, what a great song this is. Radio might not play it. People might not buy it, but I've always wanted to record a song like this, and I'm going, whoa, what a great little song. And as soon as he said that, down through the years, as I listened to songs, I'd always stick songs like that back. I'd run upon one and say, my God, what a great little song. The radio would never play this, and certainly they wouldn't ever think Conway Twitty would record this. And so I'd just stick them back and hold them, you know, because they were such great little songs. And as soon as he said it, and after that many years in the business, it opened up a gigantic door for me. It allowed me to push the boundaries of that image, and that's what Conway Twitty is, an image. To push the boundaries of that image back even further after all these years, and record things that I would never have recorded, such as the two songs that you just mentioned. And it really made me more anxious and eager to get into the studio, because I could record things that I had never recorded before. And sometimes we'll decide to release them as singles. Sometimes disc jockeys out there play them so much and people request them so much, they say, hey, that's my job. That's a great song. And I say, boy, I knew it was. Let's release it.
That's wonderful. Now you're gonna continue to do that album after album, the 6 pieces of business songs, and then the others are going to be 4 things that radio might play or adventurous type thing.
Well, no, the other 4 are what I consider songs that radio would play now. Now the other six are off out in the future song somewhere, right, you know. Right, right. But, yeah, I'm going to continue to do them just like that.
You also had some covers on a couple of great pop hits. Two come to mind. The Rose, which was beautiful. You brought life to that like it was your song alone, like it was brand new.
And Slow Hand.
And Slow Hand, of course, John Bettis' song.
I got a lot of flack from doing those two songs.
You did?
Yeah, I was in the studio a lot back then, doing a lot of things and recording the children's Christmas album thing I did. And word started coming back to me that radio stations were very unhappy, and a couple of write-ups in Billboard that they were unhappy because I was doing what they called remakes. Mm-hmm. And it really upset me. It really did. I'd never been accused of anything like that before. And I said, surely these people know that country music fans don't, you know, they never heard Slow Hand. Mm-hmm. They don't sit around and listen to the sisters that did it, right? That recorded that song in the rock field. They don't sit around and listen to that. As far as they're concerned, this is a brand new song. It's a Conway Twitty song. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it went on to become a real big record for me. And but still, they complained. And then when I came out with The Rose, they really complained. And I couldn't, it took me a long time to start figuring out why they were complaining. The Rose went on to become a huge thing for me, too. But I finally figured out why, which I won't get into here, why they were doing all this. And I said, okay, no more remakes for Conway Twitty. So I kind of got, but I, by that time I had recorded two more things, Three Times a Lady,
right,
and Heartache Tonight. And after I got through with those, I said, no more remakes. But I thought those were two really good records, too. Super records.
Super records. D, I just have Story Behind the Clown. Any special story on that?
I had that song in my office, and Jimmy Bowen was, it was my first single for Warner Brothers. I had been with MCA for years and years, and I decided that I felt like the people at MCA were beginning to take me for granted. I was still having number one records. Right. I was sort of old hat to them, and they take me for granted. You know how it is. People take you for granted when you've been around a long time. Not that they don't like what you do and all that. They'd get excited about some newer acts. And I thought, well, maybe somebody at another label would get excited about Conway Twitty. And I knew Jimmy Bowen would. So he was over at Warner Brothers. And I decided to make that change for a while. And the very first, he came out to my office and sat down and started listening. And I had a song called The Clown. And I said, I want you to listen to this because the people who are singing it are really good. They wrote this song, but you might think about signing these people. They really are good. And he listened to it. He said, Conway. He said, what do you mean? He said, this is a Conway Twitty song. We don't need to be talking about somebody signing somebody else. You need to do this. He said, it's nice of you to think about these other people, but you're going to record this song. And so we got a hold of the writers, and they were all excited, and of course I did, and it was, I think, the record of the year,
yeah,
in R&R.
That's right.
For R&R, it was the record of the year.
Yeah. One more. You want to do what? Last but not least, let's talk about a real Conway Twitty weeper, one that really gets, the ballads are your real strength. Those are the ones, if the women can cry and bring out that handkerchief, I guess the job has been accomplished, and you don't get any better than I May Never Get to Heaven in the lyric of that song.
Well, I first heard that song years ago. It was the B-side of a Don Gibson, mm-hmm, record, mm-hmm, back years ago. And I never forgot it. I never could believe that it wasn't a single. You know, it was such a great song. Buddy Killen was one of the writers on that song here in town. And I sort of stuck it back and kept it in that little box I had. And someday I'm going to record this song. Well, when the time rolled around, I went in the studio and put it all together. And when I got through with it, I was one happy dude because I always loved that song. And you don't ever know when you get in the studio when it starts coming back to you off that tape, and it comes alive or it doesn't, right?
Right.
Well, it came alive and went on to become one of my better songs, I think.
Conway, I want to congratulate you on more than 25 years, 38 years, I guess, in the business. And may you have 38 years more of health and happiness and more hit records. And all good wishes to you and Dee and all the very best. And thanks for sharing some time with us here at Twitty City today.
Right.
And good luck with the album. Always nice to see you.
Thank you, Lee. Nice to see you.
Hope you enjoyed our visit with Conway Twitty. Next week on Country Conversations, we'll have a visit with Barbara Mandrell. Until then, stay safe and keep it country.